Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Prince Fu is PwC Africa's banking and capital markets leader. If you listen to Seize the World in the Morning, as you just heard that ad, very interesting perspective on the dearly departed. If you do listen to Seize in the Morning, I was chatting to them this morning about PwC's report highlighting the very rapid digitization of banking clients in South Africa, and that outcome of 20 million users of digital apps and digital platforms in the banking sector is just one output of a broader study that they've undertaken into how South Africa's banking sector did perform in the first half of 2024. They've demonstrated some pretty strong performance, and the word they keep using is durable. I'm so excited to ask our guest, Francois Prinsloo, to take me through his definition of durable. South Africans have gone from being resilient, and now banks are durable. Welcome to Kaya Biz, Francois. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yes, nice having you. Nice having the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
Indeed. So durable was my big takeaway word from your report. Came up quite a bit in various iterations. Take us through your assessment of the durability of South African banks.
Yes, thank you. If you look at the banking results, it should always be considered in the operating environment in which these results were achieved. The start of 24 began with acute levels of uncertainty, given the number of countries that entered elections during the current year, including our in South Africa. If you look at the macroeconomic environment, these were influenced by things like geopolitical tensions and just generally elevated levels of inflation as a result of the high interest rates. And as we know, the consumer and business confidence in South Africa was relatively muted. So having said all of that, we had an electoral process in South Africa that went well and generally well received by financial markets. So with durable, I think we reference, if we look at in the context of the bank's performance, it was quite a resilient performance in these 6 months. If you look at balance sheet growth, particularly on the funding side, around 3.7% on the lending side, similar right. levels, provides a good base for growth. We've seen some good top line growth in revenue across net interest and non-interest income. And what was also very pleasing to see that even in these tough economic conditions, that the contribution by the operations in the rest of Africa, outside of South Africa, was also very strong, even despite some of the currency volatility.
Exactly. By all means.
Now, standing back, the return on equity remained very strong. If you look at that, about 16.9%, enviable by any global standards. Mm. So all important, the banks are still well capitalized and high liquidity. So overall, a very resilient and strong performance.
Let's take a step back here, Francois. I mean, you're right to say that it was a strong half, but it was also sort of a tale of two quarters, wasn't it? That first quarter that was in the murk of it, still load shedding on the horizon and a very real reality. God bless the gentleman who started Eskom Sapush, because their whole business model has been decimated by the efficiency of Eskom in the second quarter moving ahead. As of 24th of March, I suppose, just before the end of the first quarter. As you say, I suppose a little bit more clarity and positivity heading into elections, but not entirely out of the woods, even as things look a little bit better here at the tail end of the first half. Let's just talk a little bit about these strategic focuses on Africa XSA. Any countries that stand out in terms of particular focus across the sector?
Hi, there continues to be an intense focus by the major banks across Africa, and this has provided strong levels of diversity in the overall performance. However, Africa is quite nuanced, as you would well know, with both significant opportunities and some risk. So you'll see the major banks balancing the portfolio specifically in terms of market risk and sovereign risk with group-wide efficiencies. So we've seen various factors impacting results outside South Africa, such as increase in cash reserving requirements in some of the currencies, significant currency volatility, you know, things like the devaluation of the Naira and the Angolan currency comes to mind. But you know, despite that, they've continued to perform well. And yeah. I guess what the banks also see is quite a young population in Africa, a big uptake in banking services, particularly around digital products. So I think there's an overall focus across the spectrum, but also realizing that there are some risks.
What I've tend to find with the financial sector is it follows the Dutch disease process, right? I mean, so it seems as though there's quite a bit of, historically, there's a great deal of emphasis on our extractive industry or exporting countries, Nigeria, as you mentioned, Angola, Mozambique. And usually those are the first projects that attract a financial services provider. And then if and when something trickles down, then there's a little bit more attention to sort of the retail space. On the other hand, on the East African side, where, you know, the dividend, the natural dividend is a little less or a little less pronounced, maybe a little less advanced, then we take advantage of the demographic dividend. And that's where we see sort of very intense sort of banking industry like Rwanda, Kenya, more on the manufacturing side, regardless of whether there's extractive industry. And I'm curious to know whether this digital trend that PwC has seen pick up in South Africa to 20 million users since 2019 second half might find itself playing out in these countries that find themselves far more digitally connected than South Africans are, whether it's because data costs are lower or because they've leapfrogged certain parts of our own development in the financial sector.
Yeah, I think we've seen very successful digital platforms growing quite quickly in some of these regions. If you think about countries like Kenya, strong digital growth. And as I said earlier, I think it's a young population in a number of the countries. It's quite underbanked. You know, physical infrastructure is perhaps more challenging. Hence the key uptake of digital banking. And I think it's easier, it's accessible. I think connectivity is strong. So I think there's certainly a focus on digital banking growth and then certainly the efficiencies that come with that, sort of less physical infrastructure, less startup costs to do that. So the banks are quite excited about that. And it's good for the consumer, you know, it's products to the market faster, more effectively, and in your hand.
I realize that you've been running this study for quite some time. So forgive me if my if this is a legacy issue or if I'm ignorant about this. But obviously, the PwC Major Banks analysis tends to focus on Absa, FirstRand, Nedbank, and Standard Bank. And obviously, in the last several years, Capitec has emerged as the fifth largest. We've got Investec that's been around. I don't know if maybe the numbers are too small. And of course, over the past 5 years of its, albeit in its infancy, Discovery seems to be making a play for at least the digital space. Is this something that the report will expand to include over time?
Yes, I think historically the only reason we bring out the survey twice a year and it coincides with 31 December and 30 June results. So it's always just been a function of the other banks having a different financial year end. But what we do try, even though we don't incorporate the financial results, we try to take some of the thematic issues that come out of their results and incorporate that into the comment. So there's certainly a flavor of the Capitec, of the Investec in the document in terms of the qualitative comments. Gotcha. But it's purely been a year-end focus, trying to align it and getting it out very quickly after the financial reports come out.
You make a really great, you've got a segment on credit quality, loan growth. And obviously we know these things are normally the purview of those who qualify for loans and qualify for credit. And historically, from an economic study perspective on my end, the widely held view that the less wealthy are probably more burdened is, I suppose, dispelled by the fact that credit is only available to a certain level of earnings, and that for, I think, probably since sort of 2010 or the 2008 great financial crisis, at least the middle end of the market and the upper middle end of the market have been quite burdened by the debt that they've taken on. Whether it is, you know, misreading interest rate cycles, the ability to take on vehicular debt and other non-asset-backed loans, store credit and the like, is the quality of the book looking a little bit better or worse? And in what segments are you seeing that across the sector?
If you look at the credit impairment charges over the period, around 6.3% against decrease compared to June 23. And that sort of resulted in a credit loss ratio falling to about 100 basis points, and that's compared to 110 basis points in June 23. So a slight improvement in the credit quality and overall in the books. And it's an indication, I guess, sort of twofold. The consumer, it's been a tough period for the consumer, high interest rate. And I think that's across the spectrum, whether it's personal loans, mortgages, credit cards. But it also has indicated, you know, a fair bit of resilience in the sort of in customers' sort of ability to repay. But I think it's quite important to note that some of the credit modeling, some of the impairment numbers that you see contain, you know, it does contain a forward-looking element. Just how the, you know, it captures macroeconomic scenarios. And as we can all know, you know, the ECB came out with an decrease in interest rate last week. We're all waiting with bated breath for the Fed and later for the for our local regulator. So it is capturing some of that expectation in the models that interest rates are likely to come down. And then over the last period, we've also seen some resolution around some restructuring, some of large corporate debts across the ICIB businesses in South Africa. So that's all helped. I think the 100 basis points is still at the upper end of a through the cycle credit range for most of the banks. And they all expect that to lower slightly still to get more within the range.
Yeah, FNB said so.
But I mean, the banks have also been more proactive in resolution and resolving some of the challenges, better collections, more efficient in working out with the customers. So it's been a collection of various activities, but it's certainly helped, you know, to retain the credit impairment charge in a reasonable range.
Final question I have for you, Francois, is around costs. And obviously there were some key cost drivers across the sector, and your report mentions these key strategic focus areas in terms of digitizing, I suppose, and modernizing. AI is something Capitec was in the headlines for this morning in terms of trying to make their offering a little bit more accessible, efficient. They and Discovery leading there on trying to be top, and FNB actually trying to be top digital platform banks, this rise that you indicate in the use of digital platforms. The thing that always pops into mind, for I imagine many of our listeners employed by these banks, is this also looking towards cutting cost ratios through staffing?
Interestingly, if you look at the cost, you'll see that the cost to income ratio actually increased a little bit over the current period, moved up from to 53.3% to compared to 51.5%, and it's sort of, you know, attributable to operating expenses increasing 7.1% versus revenue that was up 4.9%, you know, sort of impacting the negative jaws. We still see significant focus on cost management. Certainly the areas that you focused on, massive investment in cloud-based software, security costs often dollar denominated. We haven't seen the staff cost line coming down, interestingly. And it's important that I actually think it's, you know, the investment currently in cloud-based software and digitization is bringing that more, bringing efficiency in product delivery, faster, more innovative products, and not necessarily impact staff costs. Interestingly as well, if we look at where costs are going, we're seeing the banks investing significantly in training and retraining staff to do different roles. You know, if you walk into a modern branch these days of one of the banks, you'll find that staff provide They're both advisors, cashiers. They
Yes.
provide help issue resolution. So what we've seen is actually a lot of training going in and cost going into broaden the capabilities of staff. So you'll find multi-purpose tasks. And so
That's
in short, no, I don't think at this point in time, we've actually seen cost in both those areas actually increasing.
Excellent. François Prinsloo, PwC Africa's banking and capital markets leader. Thank you so much for this. I encourage everybody to grab themselves a copy of this edition of the major South African banks report from PwC. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on Kaya Biz.
Thank you.
Indeed. It's 7 o'clock. I asked you your opinions of the National Health Insurance Bill that will be promulgated soon into an act. Have a listen to this voice note we have from Tenbar.
Good evening, Rufilwe, and all Kaya listeners. Rufilwe, I'm against the NHI bill at the moment. Yes, I can understand that the biggest idea for this NHI bill is to sort of like bridge the gap in terms of affordability for an ordinary South African. But how do we want to implement something like this if we don't have the foundation correct? I mean, we need to have all the pillars in a position where when we say this, it's time for us to implement this, we know that this thing is going to work. At the moment, it doesn't seem that way. It doesn't look that way. We're heading straight into a big problem. And I do not want to see a situation like that, because it will be us, and I'm talking us as the masses, the people that are going to be using this system, that are going to be facing the effects of the system crumbling. And while the people that say that they want to implement this, they will know that if they want a proper health service, they can go to places that they know that we can't even get to, you know. So a lot has to be fixed if this NHI bill is to work, honestly.
Thank you, Tenbar, for that comment. You're absolutely right. A lot does need to be fixed. The only thing I would just highlight is, unfortunately, we'd all be in the same boat, masses and non-masses, because what the bill or act actually enforces is that everybody needs to go to the same shop window or the same equally governed shop window, and there's no option to opt out and get a particular service from a particular place of your choosing. Once government has decided exactly what the ailments are that must be treated through the NHI, let's say it's colds and flu, let's say it's glasses and contact lenses, let's say it's diabetes, let's say it's the prescribed minimum benefit plus a chronic disease. If all of that has to be managed through the NHI, it has to be managed through the NHI, and you will not be able to claim back from medical schemes for anything other anything that is under that title, only for that which is not offered by the NHI. So, by legislating that the person who's paying for the medical scheme, their discovery, their bonitas, is unable to claim, you effectively are killing the private sector and forcing everybody to the same inefficient, understaffed, overworked shop window, and without necessarily addressing the key issues, which is not the money.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.